Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
It's an old journalism adage, right? Whenever everyone is going left, you go right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that other direction that's going to hit the sweet spot is something that you experienced, that you observed, that you're complaining to your friends and family about, and, like, you know, not underestimating the uniqueness but also the universality of your experience.
Back with us is the James Beard Award winning and the great food and culture writer Osai Endelin. So we got to talk about fried chicken, because I love fried chicken. Who doesn't? And you wrote a wonderful piece about it in You and I Eat the Same, which is this wonderful book that I wasn't even aware of until I saw your essay. And so I literally, like, I wonder if the publicist would get. And she, in an hour, she got me the book last night. So let's talk about that piece, because it's an amazing piece, because it's both a searing indictment and almost hopeful at the end. And that's a hard thing to get in one piece.
Yeah, it was a tough nut to crack. So Chris Ying, who conceived of this collection, has been working with Renee Redzepi on this series, teed me up for this piece. We had gone back and forth on a number of ideas over, I would say, maybe almost a year.
Wow.
And things were just not quite gelling. And when we finally landed on this, you know, he kind of had the premise in mind, and but let me run with it. And
the fried chicken of all nations premise.
Yes, this idea that if we start, it's obviously not true that food always brings us together, and it's obviously not true that food necessitates a further reflection on a culture, right? Like, a lot of us eat tacos or hummus without thinking anything more about where those dishes come from. But if you took the premise that we're more alike than we are different and looked at food as the medium to do that, where could you go? And this book wanted to explore, you know, migration and immigration in ways that maybe we weren't always welcoming of, you know, having those conversations. So I was really thrilled to be a part, and I felt strongly that there needed to be an African-American experience in this conversation, which, you know, sometimes, although African-American has grown to encompass many different experiences and types of movement from one diaspora to another, it often gets left out because it's really inconvenient to talk about this history that's based in so much tragedy, yet, you know, spurred so much beauty and diversity. And that's still, I think, an ongoing and fairly new conversation, the diversity of African-American cooking, which, you know, many people are on that tip, you know, and I think we're going to see more of that in the next year or two in terms of books coming out and projects that people are working on and restaurant openings. But the story for me was to look at how this chef, Morgan McGlone, who's in Australia, originally from New Zealand, came to the American South in a kind of talk about roundabout way. He had many different streams of his career, and, you know, landed in Sean Brock's kitchen.
Sean Brock is the great Southern chef from Husk.
During a time when Sean Brock was, you know, and he continues to, but doing a lot of study and reflection on the intricacies of Southern cuisine, and certainly not the only person to do it, but the exposure there was inspiring to McGlone, and he ended up taking ideas from hot chicken that he had and said, you know, this could look really great back home.
We should say that hot chicken was first made famous in Nashville.
Right.
Prince's was the legendary.
Right.
I don't know if it was really the first place, but it was certainly the first place that I went to.
Yes, and they certainly, you know, put themselves on the map as being the place where it all started. But, you know, it certainly came out of Black communities, you know, in Nashville. And, you know, he takes this idea and launches a brand in Australia that's done very well called Bell's. You know, we kind of wanted to look at this. What's the middle part there that seems interesting? You know, every culture fries bird in some way. But if you take American fried chicken out of America, what gets left behind? It's like that migration movement that we were talking about earlier. do you leave the history behind? And,
right.
And how much is that responsible? And do we even really understand the history here? And, you know, what does that, does that constrain us or does that liberate us and how? So those are some of the questions that I don't know that I really answered any of those questions.
No, but, you know, there's a great quote that you say at the end of the piece, which is you say that McGlone has landed on the two questions that give all food consequence. Is it tasty and does it mean something? And so you quickly and easily to say that fried chicken is indisputably tasty.
Indisputably.
And there was not much to say about that. It's eaten all over the planet, as you say. And you know, fried chicken is kind of like pizza because even bad fried chicken is okay.
Yeah.
I say that as someone who's written an entire book on pizza.
Yes.
And many pages on fried chicken. And so with its deliciousness unquestionable, all that remains is what fried chicken means. Mm-hmm. No matter where it's cooked, American fried chicken carries the learning and effort and skill of a people who persevered against unfathomable odds. That Southern U follows fried chicken all the way to Melbourne and Sydney, too. And therein lies an incredible opportunity. If everyone can agree to share fried chicken, then perhaps that's a step towards sharing the weight of its complex legacy as well. And that, not only is that beautiful writing, but there's a glimmer of hope there. Did you think you would land on a glimmer of hope when you first started the piece?
I think that was on the horizon. You know, you're never quite sure. I mean, sometimes an ending comes to you before you get to it. But I know that the book wanted,
since the book was about bringing people together.
I understood the book wanted to strike an optimistic tone. And I did believe that because that is a possibility. I don't know on what timeline we're talking about that actually coming to fruition. There's a lot of struggle. It doesn't always come from one direction. You know, as I mentioned in the book, because of so much of the hateful iconography that was used to depict African Americans, you know, stealing chickens and like kind of, you know, just being gluttonous chicken eaters, you know, during the post-enslavement period and, you know, into Jim Crow, you know, you have a lot of people who still feel kind of unsure about what it means to eat fried chicken, whether or not to do so in public.
Yeah, that was a fascinating sentence that even today, a lot of African American people don't want to eat fried chicken in public just because of all the baggage.
I think that's changing, but I don't think the conversation is gone internally.
Right.
At the Smithsonian's National Museum for African American History and Culture, fried chicken is on the menu, but, you know, notably of all the different regions of foodways that they explore in their cafeteria, Sweet Home Cafe, which, by the way, just came out with a beautiful cookbook, watermelon was not on the menu when I went there. And I've, you know, heard it reported that they just didn't even want to bring it in because, you know, that experience of coming through all these historic images, many of them very painful. It's like, do you want to then come into this place in the museum experience where you're resting and you're trying to recover and move on to these galleries that show the beauty of this culture and then have to deal with whether or not you want to be biting into a rind? I mean, that may have changed since I was there.
Sure.
But just the fact that these are things that people are talking about, and I think it's important to understand it's not always about something being good. Sometimes it's about what it means, you know, to have that in your household. No one in my house ever cooked fried chicken. We would sometimes have it as like a fast casual meal or even like a fast food meal. And that was rare. And I mean rare. We did not do fast food a lot in my house. But I didn't even know what it took to fry chicken until I was an adult. And then you're almost amazed that people, you know, actually that this is available for us all the time, anytime, you know, day or night. It's like, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. And you also make this really interesting observation in the same piece. There is a distinct pattern in the United States where African-American chefs struggle to find parity with their white counterparts in terms of recognition, funding, and reward. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes for many aspects of Black culture.
You know,
I spent years, as you know, 20 years working with principally African-American jazz musicians, mm-hmm. and that was the story they told every day. That was their life.
Right.
That was their life story.
Yeah.
Each and every
it's
one
like,
of them.
It's like, you know, you're supposed to do it faster with fewer resources and be more exceptional and get less credit.
Right.
That's just across the board. Yeah. And, you know, I think every industry has tried to figure out, you know, its ways of navigating that. But yeah, for sure, I've heard a lot of stories. So my grandmother's first daughter, before my mother was born, was my aunt Patrice Russian. And
I was going to say, Russian, that's a, you know, Patrice Russian is this beautiful musician.
Yeah, she's a fantastic musician. She currently chairs the pop music program at USC's Thornton Music School and has been doing really wonderful things there. But, you know, throughout her really varied career, she has had experiences as, you know, a band leader. She's a pianist, a composer.
As an African-American woman,
right,
jazz band leader.
Yes. And, you know, music director for tours, for all kinds of artists, for award shows. You know, the Grammys, NAACP Image Awards, you know, many, many different experiences, many hats that she's worn, and many accolades that she's received. But, you know, because of her multiple, you know, streams of experience, you know, she's gotten to see a lot, too. And there's a lot of unfortunate parallels that that map between, you know, Blackness in food and Blackness in music, and sort of from kind of only being expected to be able to do one genre, you know.
Sure.
You know, my aunt was classically trained. She studied, you know, as a, you know, with the jazz greats as well. You know, she understands all the technology, so she can, you know, do the newer iterations of the things that came from R&B and jazz as well. But you know, people are somehow shocked when, you know, they hear a symphony, you know,
right,
from the Detroit,
sure,
Music Orchestra.
Sure.
It's like, you know, it shouldn't be surprising to you that an African-American chef, you know, he can cook something of Asian background. She can make something that has Latin influences.
Right.
And the same thing goes, you know.
Yeah, it's sure. And, you know, now that I think about it, it's like there's a sort of link between your aunt and what Wynton Marsalis has done at Jazz at Lincoln Center, where he has, you know, he's like, I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this. I don't want to be seen as just another African-American New Orleans-born jazz musician.
And I think, you know, from my own observations, that's a perspective, and, you know, you'll have to talk to Marsalis today and find out where he's at about it. But I think that he's evolved, because I think, you know, in the earlier days, I mean, like maybe in the 90s, he was very strict about
super
wanting
purist.
It. You know, you play it this way and only this way, and
absolutely,
this is the way it's meant to be done. And I think there's a balance between recognizing tradition and valuing it and learning it and understanding it, particularly as more and more of these genres are played by people who are not African American or who did not necessarily come from these lineages. It's really important to know, like, where these, you know, where that blues scales came from,
yeah,
what prompted that. And so, you know, to know that is important, but to be able to evolve it and keep it current and making it feel, you know, alive is crucial too.
So who inspired you to be a writer? Who taught you the most about writing? This is a three-part question, so I apologize.
That's okay.
And what advice would you give to young, aspiring writers about food and culture? You have 30 seconds for me.
Well, I think the closest and most constant influence for writing came from my mom, because she encouraged me so much to read, and she was such a supporter of me reading. I really think for writers to have a chance, you have to read a lot. And that's not always the connection that people make.
Yeah.
I read a ton as a kid. I mean, it was a problem sometimes. I had books taken away from me because they were a little outside my age level.
Wow, that was never my problem.
Yeah, I got caught with reading Tina Turner's biography, and that was not a great day. I was like 10 or something. And then, you know, as I kind of started to actually think about writing professionally, I was in my late 20s. I came to it kind of late. I think for a long time I didn't know how to even conceive of a career like that. And it was really out of desperation and sort of fatigue of trying to piddle my way around that I just said, you know, screw this. I'm just going to go for what I really want. And that turned out to be the thing that had doors opening up for me. But one of my best friends, Bailey, her father, Mike DeCastro, who died a few years ago, was a huge influence on me in my writing. And he would give me a lot of constructive and sometimes difficult feedback.
Was he a writer himself?
He was. He was a writer. He was a photographer. He was brilliant. He was he was a Puerto Rican Jew living in San Francisco. And
that huge population of Puerto Rican Jews living in San Francisco.
Oh man, just like I mean, he just he was a special, special man, and I miss him a lot. And you know, he really. He gave me a lot of courage and encouragement. And I think when you're at that early period where you're trying to figure out who you are as a writer and what matters to you and, you know, what your take is on a subject that, you know, any number of people might write about, but what makes you the person to have this conversation, you know, he was very forthright with me about not bullshitting, not being too distant, you know, always pushing me to, you know, he was kind of like, blood on the page, you know, like I want to feel it, I want to see it. And so,
but you do that and you have this combination of an elegant prose stylist and being an incredibly conversational writer.
Mm.
My writing heroes were the late Nora Ephron and Bud Trillin because mm-hmm. of the way they could combine those two things.
And I think you can have writing influences from, I mean, so I loved and still love a lot of Joan Didion's writing. I think, you know, she's just a master. But I knew that wasn't quite my, you know, I tend to be a little more optimistic than Ms. Didion. So I knew that wasn't quite where I was going. But I'm trying to think of other, you know, certainly Maya Angelou, you know, I so admired, talk about a conversational writer, you know, you just felt like she was sitting next to you telling you, you know, her life story. And then you'd come across some phrasing and it's like, gosh, like how does she do that? You asked me, so who were those influences and then what would I say?
Well, you've already said you should be reading a lot.
Yes, I think reading a lot is really important. Looking inward, so often, particularly with social media, I think we're driven to go out and chase experiences and do what other people are doing. And that, to a degree, I think that can be useful because it helps give you a sense of what you think about, you know, what's trending and what's popular. But it's a old journalism adage, right? Whenever everyone is going left, you go right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that other direction that's going to hit the sweet spot is something that you experienced, that you observed, that you're complaining to your friends and family about, and like that's the thing that you should put in a couple of paragraphs and pitch it. So, you know, not underestimating the uniqueness, but also the universality of mm-hmm. your experience, I think is really important for people who are kind of starting out, and to find someone who can be a cheerleader for you, find someone who, you know, will read your shitty drafts and
And I think in my case, I actually had a great book editor who encouraged me to be both universal and unique at the same time, which is, I think, what you're saying. And you need editors that push you in both directions.
Right.
And they're hard to find.
They are hard to find. I mean, I was really lucky with Mike. I was really fortunate. I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design for my MFA. I attended the Atlanta campus. And, you know, I knew having been out of school for a few years, I studied French and Afro-American studies at UCLA. And I really didn't know what to do after that. And it was about 6 years before I applied for that grad program. But when I did, I was really clear and I was really ready. And so I, you know, everything that my professors gave me, every writer that came to visit, every office hour.
Soaked it all in.
I was like, I mean, to the point where it probably like damaged some relationships with my peers because I was just so clear. But, you know, you're paying a high price for that education and, you know, you don't want to waste time. I mean, I kind of felt like, gosh, you know, I figured this out what felt to me a little late. And so I didn't want to
waste any time.
A moment. And I feel very grateful for, you know, having those opportunities because that exploration, you know, having people who are who get lit up around your enthusiasm for learning something, that's a really special mm-hmm. relationship. And I got a lot of encouragement. You know, it was challenging, and you know, you get to try a lot of different things out. And you know, SCAD for me also was a place where, yes, it's good to kind of do what you're good at, but you're also encouraged to stretch out. You know, I tried my hand at photography. I tried my hand at printmaking. Got a whole new appreciation for what it takes to roll paper through a press and see what comes out on the other side. And those kinds of things, you know, humble you, I think, and bring you to another level of appreciation in terms of how you tell story, how you bring images to life through words. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think cross-pollinating yourself, too, as a writer is important. You know, I was at a performance space last night, this beautiful exhibit that just closed called Black Power Naps, where these artists, Niv Acosta and Fanny Sosa, had created a physical space for Black people to rest, inspired by it's a study they had observed where African Americans are the least rested demographic in our nation.
Wow.
And this idea that, you know, hey, if you see people lying down in this space, don't call the police, right? And they had all this verbiage that, but it was also like this really nurturing, soothing environment there. Everyone was just kind of lounging. That is influencing me as a storyteller, right? So, you know, having the openness to go and investigate things like that.
That's great.
I think is important.
So now it's time for the All You Can Answer Special Sauce Buffet. So we don't have a bell that we ring, but we ask you to move along in a timely manner.
Yes.
Who's at your last supper? No family allowed. And it can be people living or dead, artists, musicians, politicians, anybody that you think would be interesting to share your last supper with?
So, Ida B. Wells, the journalist and activist, she was talking about lynching before a lot of people were, and advocating for you know, African Americans to be liberated and to be really free, really, really, truly free.
And it's not a name that you hear very often. I've only read a little bit about her.
Yeah, I need to know more about her, but just from, you know, one of these, I'm kind of on a project right now, we're starting to explore the sort of undertold African-American figures of American history. And I think that she's someone who I'm starting to learn more about and be kind of riveted by how brave and courageous she was.
All right, so she's there.
So she's there. Also because I think a lot of these figures, you know, get like kind of tied up in their import, but you know, she probably had to have a pretty good sense of humor.
All right.
You know, Zora Neale Hurston, I think, is up there too. It's another writer, of course, that as many of us love from, you know, Their Eyes Were Watching God and so many other, more recently, Barracoon, her long awaited nonfiction work. I think Diane Reeves is a just phenomenal,
great jazz
vocalist,
singer.
And I've seen her perform so many times. I've never really had a conversation with her. I used to work at a, you know, concert production, so I would actually be very close to her proximity-wise. But, you know, she's someone who brings so much of herself to her performance. You know, no single iteration is the same.
And yeah, she's a great singer.
A joy to speak
and I think an underappreciated great jazz singer, because she's a phenomenal improviser.
Oh, she's a joy. I don't know. I think those ladies would probably be at the table.
I think we're good.
Yeah.
So what are you eating?
What are we eating at the dinner?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I would love a persimmon dish on this.
All right,
spread.
You're the first person who's ever said persimmon dish, but keep going.
Some kind of like persimmon dish. I think it would be great. Maybe some like roasted lamb.
Like a barbacoa or just like a lamb roast.
Yeah, I think, you know, some
lamb chops,
some umami in there with maybe like some anchovy, olive oil paste, some herbs.
I like
herbs.
This.
I don't know why, but I think Dan Dan noodles should be on this table. There ought to be some biscuits or like a cornbread. Or
all right.
Like that.
And then all that's left is a dessert.
A dessert. Well, we need a vegetable. Maybe like Brussels. I love like roasted Brussels.
Okay.
And pecan pie, probably.
Pecan pie. All right. I like it.
So
what's on your nightstand right now, book-wise?
Oh, literally. I have my sister is a serial killer. the novel.
Okay.
It's a fairly new book. Jessamyn Ward, Salvage the Bones.
I've read a lot about that book, but
yeah, it's striking. And I also have a Bunk by Kevin Young, the noted poet who's also the director of the Schomburg Center for Black Culture Research. But he does this interesting investigation into kind of how we start to tell lies culturally. And it's an interesting book to read now.
Cool.
Yeah.
So who would you love to have a one-on-one lunch with just to see how she or he thinks?
You know, I think it would be really cool to sit down with Ava DuVernay, the film director.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I understand a lot about how she thinks because she's been so open about you know, her processes. But, you know, yeah, that would be
yeah,
fun.
I like that.
To talk to more.
So it's just been declared Osai Enderlin Day all over the world. Okay, I just declared it. What's happening on that day? What are people doing?
People are maybe if like – so I love – body and energy work. So there's going to be yoga classes at different levels if you're interested.
Every block.
For everyone. There's going to be massage therapy. I really love a good reflexology.
All right.
There's going to be Swedish fish for everyone. And
so I like the combination of Swedish fish and yoga.
Yes. And there will be any book you want, it will just appear in front of you.
Got it.
Yes. For free. Yeah. You can just have
I
that
like
book.
That.
Yeah.
That's an awesome day.
And I think that there will also be maybe jollof rice for everyone.
Jollof rice.
Yes. Yes.
We should explain that jollof rice is native to.
Well, that's a big debate.
Yeah, I know.
How you but ask. But you know, from my neck of the woods, that's you know, it's a Nigerian tomato-based rice dish that you know, if you're familiar with like red rice, Savannah red rice, you know, you're going to have a sense of jollof rice, which tends to have, I think a more robust flavor profile.
Yeah, more intense for sure.
But sort of kind of that ceremonial party dish that. You can't do without.
Yeah.
But you know the Senegalese and the Ghanaians and the.
So there's jollof rice and Swedish fish for food. I like that. It's very colorful. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Osai Enderlin.
It's been great.
Do pick up a copy of You and I Eat the Same on the countless ways food and cooking connect us to one another, and read her brilliant take on fried chicken. And go to osaiendelin.com, which is what I did, where you'll find a great introduction to her work. And soon, hopefully, you'll be seeing Osai's writing on Serious Eats.
Let's make it happen.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.